Like James Bond versus the zombies. We're talking about theories of international politics and zombies with Dr. Daniel Dresner, Tufts University professor, and we're taking it apart. We're looking at where we are versus where we need to be in preparation for the inevitable zombie war. How will we survive? What can we do now better to prepare for the zombie apocalypse when the dead once more walk the earth with one sole purpose, and that is to make a feast of the living? And some countries will do better than others. Who will likely survive? We'll get into this coming up a little bit more, but also a couple of points about our human natures that we can use to predict how badly we might handle this in the future. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. You know, if we're using the history as a predictor of the future, I want to bring up an issue that I don't look at as a fault in the work that you did here in Theories of International Politics and Zombies, Dr. Dresner. But I am, as a person of faith, I would be remiss in not being cognizant of, and that is the very strong possibility that we would see a rise again in irrational antisemitism as a result of a zombie apocalypse. We've seen it with every plague. We see an undercurrent of it still bubbling in the world today. We saw it with, you know, in World War II. And I wonder whether, as has happened in the past with the, you know, with the Black Death in the Middle Ages, that people would see this as being some sort of symptom of the a new world order, or an indication that somebody out there has introduced this virus to depopulate the planet, and this was all part of an international banking conspiracy or into the whole anti-Zionist thing. And you know, we just it seems to be a default position that some people will go to because they're always looking for some sort of handy, if not mythical, villain.
I think that's definitely, I think it's a valid criticism of the work, and that one of the things that is, as I've presented this material, you know, in a variety of different conferences, it occurs to me that I should have stressed more was that if, in fact, the dead were starting to, the living dead started to exist, you would probably see a rise in all sorts of religious movements and all sorts of conspiracy theories as well. And this, again, partially depends upon where they're going to emerge from. But, I mean, I guarantee you that, you know, once zombies start walking the earth, I mean, how long is it going to take before they're automatically linked to the CIA, for example? Not say that the CIA would actually be responsible, but you would see a lot of credible conspiracies blaming either the CIA, the Mossad, the international financial conspiracy, the Illuminati, you name it. So you're right that there would probably be a growth of a sort of conspiracy-minded, there would be a growth in the conspiracy mindset out there. I think one of the interesting things to think about is the role that the internet would actually play in either spreading these conspiracies or debunking these conspiracies.
Right. Well, and I would say, too, there may be conspiracies involved in the spread of a zombie apocalypse. It might serve the political interests of some countries to allow their people to be the victims, to be the human buffet for a zombie apocalypse. Again, you're looking at like Libya
or a Nazi zombie apocalypse,
which is a whole other thing. But yeah, you get into like Libya, and right now, what would you know, what would Muammar Gaddafi do if he had the ability to depopulate his country and remain at the top in a much, you know, smaller, destabilized threat underneath?
I think that's something you have to consider, although I will say this. It's interesting to note that I have a colleague, Rob Farley, who's a professor at the Patterson School in Kentucky, who has actually run simulations to see how different states would respond to a zombie threat. And what he found, which was very interesting, is that the states, by and large, the great powers would never do this kind of thing. They would never try to use the zombies tactically. That you're right, though, that rogue states might consider it, but in the end, they actually wind up not doing it so much. It's actually the non-state actors that are the source you have to be
explain that
about.
Meme.
Well, that actors like Al-Qaeda, for example. Al-Qaeda, you could see trying to use zombies as the sort of new suicide bomber. that, you know, it would be easy to use the undead as a way to sort of, you know, wreak havoc on civilization as we know it. And really, in some ways, that's the key. The key is does the state or does the actor involved really want to try to bring down civilization? As much as Gaddafi might look like a zombie, and as much as he might be willing to subjugate his own population, I think even he would be worried about the you know, implications of trying to use the undead as a sort of way in which he could maintain power in Libya, because even if he were to successfully kill his own people, he'd then have to figure out how to kill the zombies, and that would be kind of tricky.
Well, I could see that as sort of this low-tech anti-personnel weapon that you could fill up train cars full of zombies. You don't have to feed them. You don't have to water them. You load them onto, these giant ships that bring them into any port somewhere. And all you have to do is have one operative that's there to open up those train cars and let them out in the middle of the night. And next thing you know, you've got zombies, you know, starting in the wharfs, starting in our most populated ocean side cities, moving inward simultaneously.
True, but you also again have to be worried about blowback, which is, even if you do this, the question is at what point you then have to deal with the zombie threat yourself. So in some ways, I don't know
that they all think that far ahead. I mean, I think that somebody like a Muammar Gaddafi, he knows he's not going to live forever. So if all he did is live, you know, freely in his opulence for another 10 years, he'll die long before he gets the blowback from the zombie apocalypse.
That's certainly one possible option. But again, what's surprising is very often how the sort of lack of creativity that even rogue states have in terms of trying to take advantage of these kinds of new threats. I mean, it's interesting to note that, you know, rogue states like North Korea, for example, while they do, you know, occasionally launch terrorist attacks or things like that, they've been reluctant to use, you know, things like bioterror or anything like that. And you know, what's interesting is we know from their response in World War Z, North Korea responds to the undead threat by simply all going underground and disappearing.
Right.
So, you know, it's not clear. Again, this is not to, you know, say rogue states are great after all, but it's not clear that they would actually be so bold as to use this kind of threat or have the imagination to think about how to creatively use this.
Yeah, fair enough. Looking back, though, you said something interesting about states that might not be a player right now in the world might suddenly find that they have become elevated in the world theater as a result of this. And I think that a state like that might be Haiti. And since we played the bumper from Live and Let Die at the top of the hour, I'm reminded that in Haiti, there you have a population that is not only accustomed to, they're not only acculturated to zombies, but also to stopping zombies. And suddenly they would be a resource for other countries who had been living in a state of denial.
That's true. And I mean, there's a law on the books in Haiti preventing, you know, that does not allow the zombification of individuals. Although, again, here you're talking about different kinds of zombies, because the sort of Haitian zombies, you know, are the ones where a bakor or witch doctor, a shaman, you know, essentially purposefully tries to kill the person and then resurrects them. And that kind of zombie is different from the sort of flesh-eating ghouls that we've been talking about in two ways. First, they cannot create more zombies themselves. They're not interested in biting other people. And even if they did, that they wouldn't necessarily spread the zombie virus. The second thing is that usually these zombies function as slaves, which is to say they will
drones of sorts.
Yeah, right. They're sort of the beck and call of the witch doctor. So in some ways, the threat from those zombies comes from the Bakor themselves. But you're right. At least, you know, the government of Haiti has actually had to think about this problem somewhat, and, you know, has gone so far as to regulate it. So I do think that is a resource, you know, that you would want to draw upon if, in fact, you were faced with a truly undead menace.
The international organizations that are already established that would be called upon in, as you described, the international liberalism school of thought on this would seemingly not be prepared for the tough duty of a zombie eradication. The United Nations Security Council, God bless the the guys in the powder blue helmets, but this is not the kind of thing that they have been trained for. The World Health Organization or the International Organization for Migration, none of these groups would have it in their charter, have it in their philosophy, have it in their DNA to be able to stop a transnational Nazi zombie migration. So tell me about the World Zombie Organization.
Well, if it were created, I mean, we don't know that this would happen, but you're absolutely right that, you know, one of the likely outcomes would be the creation of a new organization because this threat is so unusual. You know, one would hope that it would deal with the sort of full spectrum of ways in which the zombies would actually affect human society. So, again, you'd obviously have to create new and pretty stringent regulations for the trade of goods and services, you know, to make sure that the zombie virus wasn't, you know, carried from border to border. I hate to say this, but I'm pretty sure that the TSA and other sort of airplane requirements in terms of trying to fly from country to country, they'd only get more onerous as a result. And then you'd, of course, have to see whether or not you could create a multilateral force that would be designed to actually go in and take the fight to the zombies, as it were, to prevent their spread physically. And, you know, I think there would have to be obviously a military component to this. But even, you know, if you were to create a World Zombie Organization, the military front would probably function much like a UN peacekeeping mission. The fact is that even liberals would acknowledge that states would be reluctant to completely surrender their sovereignty in terms of their military forces to a supranational organization. So in some ways, I think you'd see the body that would function like a World Zombie Organization would probably function like NATO, where you would hopefully have a joint integrated command, but still, you know, countries would command their own soldiers also.
I want to read a little bit from Theories of International Politics and Zombies. You write, authoritarian countries are often reluctant to admit health crises because of the threat that such an admission could have on state control over society. Non-democratic regimes are less likely to invest in the public goods necessary to prevent or contain disasters. There is one reason why the loss of life from disasters is greater in authoritarian countries. Local officials could delay reporting a zombie outbreak up the chain of command for fear of being the bearer of bad news. Boy, did that just totally rings true with me.
No, and you know, unfortunately, we can see that based on how things have played out, for example, with tsunami in Japan, as compared to the loss of life during the tsunami that hit in very late 2004, early 2005. Generally speaking, the countries that do better with zombie-like disasters or other natural disasters are, first, not shockingly, affluent countries, but second, democracies, that holding everything else constant, there's always less loss of life in democracies than with authoritarian states.
I want to move on here to neoconservatism and the access of evil dead in just a moment. But before I do, there was one thing I don't know that I saw addressed in the work that you did here in Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and that is how hard it would be for certain cultures over others to kill their ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
Because ancestor worship, to coin, you know, a phrase, is so strong in some groups. In some Asian societies, for example, the emphasis on the importance of the elder, or for the reverence that people still pay to those people who are past, but whose influence continues on in the family. I think they would find it very hard if great-grandfather were once more walking the earth to shoot him in the head.
I think you're correct that this would probably cause an initial reluctance to do this sort of thing. And so that, again, there might be certain cultures where the initial spread might be faster because there would be cultural inhibitions against truly taking out the walking dead. That said, I tend to think that, you know, once their behavior became more and more obvious over time, that those sorts of cultural norms would likely fall pretty quickly.
You know, I don't know that, and I wonder what the timeline would be and how that would complicate things. Because I think that, for example, the Japanese You know, they are in a democratic state, but they have a very different view of the role of the elder than, say, the United States. I think it'd be much easier for people to dispense, sadly, with a revisiting, recently reanimated elder. And for that matter, and I don't even know enough about other countries or other cultures around the world to say how much of a problem that might be. If you had 50% of the cultures of Asia, you know, Indonesia, Africa, if they were reluctant to act on that because this is a thought that might have been part of their world belief from the very beginning, that someday great-grandpa will return, and suddenly great-grandpa is back, I think it would be hard to convince them that great-grandpa is a threat and not a salvation.
Well, one way to look at it, though, is the following, which is usually the societies that you're talking about that are deferential to elders are also often deferential to governments. And so as a result, if the governments were to, you know, in these countries were to start issuing edicts arguing, look, we know that you want to respect your elders, but these people just want to eat your limbs and your entrails, that would probably cause you'd have conflicting imperatives, but it would at least shake the family perception that they would want to, you know, automatically do what their, you know, undead, rotting corpse elders would want them to do.
I wonder whether there might develop, and this is something which would be very sad for me, but I wonder whether the inevitable reaction would be a giving up to that elder zombie, a current member of the family, as a kind of a tribute, as sort of a, you know, you have, you're back, you have, you know, we're going to give you this uncle or this cousin, or other people would be willing to sacrifice. And in fact, they would end up feeding the undead for a period of time before they started to repel them. But we'll put that away for now, since I really am interested in your view on neoconservatism and the axis of the evil dead. As we were talking about liberalism, let's move on to conservatism. And in this case, a particular brand of conservatism when we look at international adventures.
Well, neoconservatism is sort of an interesting mixture of other views. But basically, what neocons are distinct from other sorts of theories of international relations is that neoconservatives believe that the domestic politics and domestic regime type of countries really matter. That crudely put, that neoconservatives in some ways are the extreme version of liberals, in that they actually agree that the world is much, much, much safer if it's all democratic. That autocracies and authoritarian states are truly pernicious elements of world politics. That they don't comply with international treaties, and they subjugate their own populations and so on and so forth. So, what neocons argue is that by and large the world is safer if the more powerful actors out there are democracies. And in contrast to realists, for example, realists generally believe in the balance of power. They believe that states will balance against the greatest threat. Neocons generally assume that bandwagoning goes on, that in some ways they actually agree with Osama bin Laden that states are more likely to back the strong horse rather than the weak horse. So you therefore want an extremely powerful democratic hegemon, and that's the best way you can promote world order. And that, you know, but whereas neocons do agree with realists, is that they're both skeptical of international institutions. Neoconservatives generally believe that international institutions are the weapons of the weak and the cynical and the autocratic, and they're designed to really constrain democracies. That authoritarian states will say they will adhere to international norms but not actually do so, whereas democracies, because they respect the rule of law, will do so, and as a result, this hampers them tremendously.
So do we believe then that a neoconservative regime would be much more proactive than a liberal regime? They would be more inclined to try to stop the zombie threat in a foreign country, even without, say, you know, some
UN
sort of
permission, for example.
UN permission, some sort of protocol that gave them the right to go in and eradicate, just on the basis of you are a threat to us, you are not handling your zombie problem, we're going to come in and solve it for you, you'll thank us later. But right now, we're not giving you a choice. Do we think that's what would be the neoconservative position?
It is to neoconservatives' credit that they would recognize very early on that zombies represent an existential threat to humanity, that zombies would hate humans for our freedoms, namely our freedom not to eat other people's brains. And so as a result, neocons would be much more likely to recommend an aggressive militarized response, regardless of what international and multilateral institutions would suggest, and try to take the fight to the zombies.
Okay. I want to pick it up right there then in just a minute, because I think that begs the question, where do human rights come into this? Are we so quick to think that there will not be organizations out there protecting the rights of the undead and would be able to make that case in a court? Theories of International Politics and Zombies. This is Ian Punnett. I'm going through which one of our political systems, which countries would do best, who would thrive and who would dive in the face of a zombie apocalypse. Theories of International Politics and Zombies. We'll get back to this before we get to your phone calls at the top of the hour with Dr. Daniel Dresner from Tufts University on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. You know, you will be able to link up to Dr. Daniel Dresner through coasttocoastam.com, Theories of International Politics and Zombies. It's out from Princeton Press. And I don't know what the biggest selling book is in the history of Princeton Press, but I got to like your chances here, Daniel, for having a bestseller in the hallways there.
It's selling very well, especially by academic press standards, let's put it that way.
Yes, exactly. By academic press standards, where a good 500, book run would be considered kind of a good day at the office. Theories of International Politics and Zombies, though, takes it really the conversation into a very different dimension. Not only understand which systems we have at work and we have traditionally seen clashing here in the United States, but also across the globe. We'll pick some winners and losers in just a moment. But let's go back to where we left off with neoconservatism,
right,
and the idea of going out and attacking the zombie threat as it exists in other countries, even if we don't have the permission,
right,
of the country. And I think Libya is kind of an interesting example right now. What exactly is our, what are we using as our right to go in and bomb a sovereign nation? It's a little murky, except it all seems to fall into the category of a greater good.
Well, I think the difference is that the neoconservatives would have never waited for the UN Security Council to authorize the invasion, and I don't think they would have been terribly keen on relying on NATO to oversee the airstrikes. I think the neocon response would be, you're either with us or against us, and they would want to take the fight to the zombies with the hope that, a massive, exercise in both air power, reliance on local allies and maybe special forces would literally shock and awe the undead into extinction. The problem, as I said in the book, is that it is highly unlikely that the neocons would stop with the zombies. They would obviously assume that the zombies would be getting help from the rest of democracy's enemies. So they would posit the existence of an axis of evil dead, in which the zombies clearly had to be thought of as allies of, other authoritarian states, such as China or Russia or Iran. And as a result, neocons would probably be willing to, expand the fight to address not just the zombies, but also, any state which was thought to be even mildly friendly to the zombies would be thought of as an ally of the zombies, and therefore it would encourage a much wider conflict. And this would obviously undercut coalition warfare somewhat, so that would potentially compromise military integrity. And, of course, the other problem is, and we know this from World War Z, is that you really can't shock and awe zombies. They don't feel fear. So I'm a little worried that the sort of military tactics that neoconservatives would recommend would work all that well when dealing with flesh-eating ghouls.
Yeah, because as you point out, what if the enemy can't be shocked and awed, not just won't, but biologically can't be shocked and awed? And yet your point is taken then. A war against zombies would be a war against evil itself. It is sort of the ultimate rallying point for people of faith, for even for people who never thought about some sort of holy war, you would see this as a war against the unholy. And it might be a terrific way to bring a coalition together that, you know, that we might not have seen in 60 years in this country.
That's absolutely true. However, again, the question becomes whether or not the neoconservatives, you know, in their aggression would actually undercut the sort of unity that you would expect both domestically and internationally to take the fight against the undead. So, for example, one obvious response that you might see, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, is that, you know, just as surely as you would see the creation of a global counter-zombie regime, you would also inevitably see the creation of global civil society movements that would protest this sort of treatment of the undead, that would promote the spread of undead rights. You know, you could see groups like Zombies Without Borders, a Zombie Rights Watch, People for the Ethical Treatment of Zombies, all of which would demand, you know, that the undead would have certain kinds of rights that would have to be respected. And this would inevitably hamper or impair, you know, the effectiveness of any kind of global counter-zombie regime.
Well, but I think it's a fair question, is who are we to decide when somebody's rights as a human being has ended? And we don't have it written into our Constitution. It might require an amendment that says your rights as a human being are terminated with your last breath.
There's no question that the zombies raise profound and serious legal questions, both in the domestic and the international level. And, you know, to be fair, it is also possible, you know, you're assuming that zombies are an implacable enemy, but maybe it's the case that you could actually, you know, you could, there, the peaceful coexistence could be possible between humans and zombies. It's not clear. You know, it might be the case that, in fact, if you were to engage in, you know, significant abuses of zombies, that would merely enrage the other zombies even further. And that's something you have to consider.
Well, and that does presuppose that there could be someday a zombie hierarchy,
right.
And that that there could be upwardly mobile zombies, or zombies having, whether it's a macro evolution or just a little micro evolution, that there might be some that might be less affected for whatever reason from the virus that started the zombie apocalypse, or the, you know, something that that came as a result of, and we haven't even thought about this, the quality of the blood and the flesh of those on whom they're feasting.
That's an interesting possibility. In other words, that you know, the smarter brains you eat, the more, you know, the more intelligent the zombie gets. That's certainly possible.
Well, we see that in our, you know, anthropological record, the more protein we had,
right.
You know, the more we created protein, you know, a protein strong brain, and the more we were able to evolve from there. But, you know, even going back to the neoconservative position and the zombies, we would have to, I think, create new laws. We would have to take we have to have a very clear understanding of when somebody's rights ended, because in a way, I mean, some of the neoconservative position has been to try to grant more and more human rights to the unborn. So if you're going to grant rights to the unborn, then what about to the undead?
As I said, this does raise profound, you know, and there's a raging philosophical debate about whether or not, you know, how you would treat zombies. So, you know, I mean, in some ways, I was very glad that, you know, as an international relations scholar, I was able to add to this literature, because there really was a zombie gap in international relations. But other cognate disciplines have been doing work on this.
All right. So let's jump forward a little bit and just say, if you are to assess where we stand now, and taking the givens that we started with about the nature of a transnational zombie threat, which countries do you think are best positioned to survive a zombie apocalypse with as little a compromise on their standard of living as they have right now?
Well, again, you'd probably want a relatively wealthy and affluent society, and also one where there was sufficient sort of decentralized authority, such that you could have an immediate local response relatively quickly, and also that had, you know, a strong sort of command and control infrastructure, so that resources could put to the places where zombies were afflicted the most. The other thing you ideally want would be some place that would presumably be a little more remote, because that might mean that you would have more warning if the zombies were in fact going to come. So, you know, the United States would certainly be a country that would be reasonably well prepared with the zombie apocalypse. Canada would also be a place, you know, where the terrain is such that it would probably be easy to take care of the zombies. My personal choice for, you know, preference, if I had to pick a country where I would want to be, I would actually pick New Zealand. Because New Zealand is in some ways the more geographically remote from sort of standard population centers. You know, it's also very mountainous, and we don't see zombies climb all that well. They also have excellent wine, so, you know, it's not like you, you would suffer all that much if you were there. You know, the places you would not want to be would be places where there was an incredibly high population density and incredibly low health infrastructures. And or state control. So someplace like Pakistan would probably be one of the worst places to be.
When you were like sort of laying it out there, you were saying New Zealand. I was thinking Scotland.
Scotland could be good too. Also, you know, that's also the Scottish Highlands. I think the venison is much better in New Zealand. So that's another, and then the weather is a little more, you know, temperate down there.
And you have lots of sheep for company in,
exactly
in
yes
New
you know and it's really either you or the sheep, so you know it lots of protein that you'd be able to consume down there.
Let me ask you about where you see the role of any of our internal political groups in this. You know, we see the talk all the time of a third party in the United States, and most of our politics are kind of polarized between slightly left of center, slightly right of center in the traditional Democratic, Republican, you know, hornlock. Mm-hmm. But I wonder whether this would open the door for a third party. That third party platform that they've never seemed to come up with one up until now that has gotten a real, that's gotten some serious traction. There's some entertainment. Seems like, you know, there's a lot of a la carte sort of a buffet style politics and a third party, a little of this, a little of that, a little from column A, a little from column B. But I wonder whether this preparation for a zombie apocalypse really would give a platform, a strong platform that may not be relevant in 2012, maybe not even 2016, but suddenly it would build credibility toward a third party that that would leave the Democrats and the Republicans sort of flat footed.
I think that's one possibility. I mean, certainly, particularly if a third party were to emerge based on the notion that this is a possible threat and then the zombies were to come up, obviously it would bolster the third party's cause. I mean, in some ways, you know, what you're seeing a lot of the sort of Tea Party activists, you know, talking about in terms of things like, you know, the Second Amendment and also the notion that, you know, you need to have a well-regulated militia, that would certainly dovetail very nicely with, you know, trying to combat the spread of the undead. So that's certainly possible. But that said, you know, the other thing that you have to consider is that if the zombies were to actually emerge, there is a natural tendency in democracies to, it's called the rally around the flag effect, which is to say that in an emergency, you know, generally people will support whoever's in power. I mean, think about, you know, right after the 9/11 attacks, George W. Bush's popularity ratings, his poll ratings went from something like 50% to approximately 90%. You would likely see a similar phenomenon take place depending upon who is the president.
Okay.
So if this would take place with President Obama, for example, his popularity ratings would likely go up. If it was someone else after him, their popularity ratings would go up as well, and presumably their party would benefit also.
Well, I would still say it depends on how they handle it. I mean,
that's true. I think there would be an initial display of support.
Sure.
It depends really on how the government responds. But if the government was able to have a reasonably effective response, then whoever with the party in power would benefit far more than a third party, would be my point.
Do you think that the American public could handle the available literature now, really what's already being discussed and the scenarios that are no doubt being worked on in some dark lower inner recess of the Pentagon or, you know, some RAND think tank somewhere? Do you think the American public can handle the reality of a zombie apocalypse?
It's not clear. You know, there's sort of two stories you can tell. The first is, is that generally speaking, you know, if you take a look at the sort of literature on the sociology of panic, by and large, you know, when confronted with sort of disaster-like scenarios, human beings are remarkably resilient. There actually is very little panic in things like, you know, hurricanes or earthquakes or tsunamis or things like that. That while the media will often sensationalize what little panic you do see, by and large, you know, human societies and even, you know, American society as well have coped pretty well with these sort of adverse shocks. So that's the positive story. The negative story is that the one exception to this, the one thing in which you often do see panic or hysteria is in response to new diseases and, you know, instances in which it's possible for anyone to become infected with a disease. Think about the initial response when the AIDS virus emerged in the 80s.
Right.
You know, all these sorts of relatively silly myths about the ways in which you could get them. You know, the fact that it took a very long time for the U.S. government to acknowledge that this was both a health epidemic and that, in fact, it was, you know, transmitted through sexual intercourse. So, unfortunately, zombies, you know, a sort of zombie epidemic would likely prey upon those human fears as well. So it's not clear how Americans would respond.
Well, I think we can predict, if then to use the AIDS model, that Americans would begin to take more seriously, perhaps even human beings across the planet, would be willing to take more seriously the threat or even the phenomenological existence of the zombie problem when it was a celebrity. We look at our celebrity culture changed the perception of AIDS. And so really when, if it's the zombie Rock Hudson,
yes,
or the, you know, the zombie Liberace, or
the zombie Lindsay Lohan,
whatever. Yeah. But yet when somebody who comes out and says, well, oh my God, they're living again, we know they were dead, this really must be a problem. It would have to be almost somebody like that. And somebody, maybe I would argue, maybe a comedian, somebody who is known for being very funny, whose personality was big and vibrant when they were alive. And then their zombiness would stand in such stark contrast that's the moment that it would seek in. That's the moment that the truth would penetrate. Oh, my God, look, we're up. That is not the same person that we knew when they were alive.
So you're arguing that like a zombie George Carlin would be the true break point, which would sort of shake humanity or shake Americans out of their sort of torpor.
Right. As opposed to, say, like a zombie Abe Vigoda, because who could tell?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, so you'd need somebody like that would draw such, you know, awareness to it just by the fact that you were so profoundly aware that it was not like the person that we knew.
No, that's an interesting point. But I mean, the other thing we'd have to be concerned about, frankly, is, again, this depends upon where you would see zombies develop initially. Where would they start in the United States? So, you know, unfortunately, you know, if you remember when the AIDS virus broke out, it was concentrated initially among Haitian Americans, actually.
Right.
And so there was a fear that, you know, well, if you're surrounded by Haitians, that's a problem. If there was a particular minority group that was particularly vulnerable to zombies for some reason or another because of their origins, you know, you'd probably see, you know, sort of, you know, new discrimination in the United States emerge as well.
Well, and again, I think that goes back to one thing that I would be very concerned about would be an immediate rise of anti-Semitism based on Jewish burial practices.
That'd be something to concern. Although, you know, Jewish burial practices are such that you have to bury the corpse within 24 hours.
That's what I mean. And that's different. You know, I'm just using the model of how some people react. You know, that's different. You know, they were dead. They put them in the ground right away. And now they're back, as opposed to embalming and as opposed to other practices that other religious groups follow.
Well, yeah, but you know, you have to consider which would be the practices that would actually encourage the spread of zombies. So, for example, the Catholic wake, I think, you know, probably zombies would spread much more vigorously among the Catholic population than it would among the Jewish population.
Oh, I'm not saying it's rational. I mean, remember so much of the pogroms against the Jews in the Dark Ages were generated because they didn't kill cats, you know, because
no, you're right. And in some ways, if there were minorities that actually didn't get, you know, weren't susceptible to zombies for some reason, then you would likely see accusations of, oh, they must be somehow behind the threat.
Exactly.
Or, you know, they must. So you're right. I mean, there would that is a possibility.
Well, I just think it's something, again, that we can benefit from, to as much as it's uncomplimentary to the way we like to think we're going to be at a time of crisis. I think it's something we should always anticipate, is that there will be a certain percentage, and a loud percentage, a populist voice that will see an immediate benefit, not from bringing people together and not from identifying the real threat, but by being able to manipulate the circumstances for their own, perhaps even short-term financial or political gain. Well, that brings us to the part here where I just can't wait to see where you all will go with this. Theories of international politics and zombies. What are your concerns? What are your hopes? Dr. Daniel Dresner takes your calls next on Coast to Coast.